I was a lucky teenager to have people in my home congregation who cared enough about me to parent me alongside my own mother and father. One woman in particular took on the role of advocating for my future in a way that my own parents could not. Her name is Vicki Wyda. Among other things, Vicki made sure the church had a youth group for its teens. I remember, she was one of our advisors, and I have a close relationship with her to this day. I remember how Vicki told me once, "If you want to change the world, serve a congregation." I knew immediately what she meant. If I wanted to affect change in the world, the best place for me to do it was in the context of religious community. How I was going to make that happen, however, was completely beyond me. Luckily, Vicki could see that I was called to the ministry even before I could, and she had a plan. She wisely planted seeds in my imagination that would lead me toward this vocation that I love. Seeds that were strong and resilient. They could sprout and grow even when my working class family discouraged me from getting a college education. They could sprout and grow even when being an openly gay man shut many, many doors to ministry. They could sprout and grow when being exclusively Christian was no longer an option for me. If you want to change the world, serve a congregation. And so I do. There is nothing like the first 10 years of ministry to wear down the enthusiasm of a newly minted minister to something realistic. The first 10 years of parish ministry are invigorating and so very hard. Many ministers don't survive them. These years are the school of hard knocks. In the first 10 years of ministry, I learned some key lessons. Don't go to the grocery store after you have gone to the gym, even if it's on the way home. Learn to spot a city councilman a block away so that you can either march right up to him or duck down another street. Always be in the first couple of photos after the wedding. If you don't do that, you will be there all afternoon. Make sure that teens on a trip go on excursions in groups of three or more. They will be far less likely to get into mischief that way. Never do a wedding in a bar. The wedding party will have arrived hours before you and will make you wish that you were drunk too. If the person on an airplane next to you wants to know what you do, just get it over with and tell her you're a minister. If you tell her you're an accountant, then she will only ask about tax deductions, and then you'll be in real trouble. Don't stand too close to the hole at a graveside funeral service, especially if it has been raining. It might be more than one leg that goes in. Never hand a microphone to anyone whom you are not prepared to get it back from. And if the ring bearer at a wedding has the actual rings on his little pillow, get that pillow away from him before he can run off, especially if the ring bearer is a dog. If you want to change the world, serve a congregation. If it were only that simple. We have all taken large risks before. We all do things that make us wonder if we were crazy to even try. We all make lots of mistakes, some of them over and over again. And in this way, we are so very human. Our species has always learned from trial and error. We have always had a staggering appetite for the ridiculous, the absurd, and the foolhardy. Yet studies show that the people who succeed in life, especially the leaders, learn much more from their mistakes than they learn from their successes. Perhaps you have seen those inspirational billboards along the sides of highways that feature a large photograph of a famous person and a brief slogan like inspiration, or never give up, or determination. George Washington, Oprah Winfrey, Mother Teresa, Albert Einstein, Babe Ruth, Nelson Mandela, Jackie Robinson, Kermit the Frog. These are the kinds of figures whose faces look back at us as we drive by. Though they are remembered as successful, each of the men and women and amphibians featured in this inspirational campaign also knew his or her share of failure, pain, and loss. Each tried many things in life before succeeding and making a difference. History reminds us of all the elections Abraham Lincoln lost before he was elected to the Illinois State House. Over and over, the man who would become one of our country's greatest leaders was told that he was not wanted. And over again, he persevered, learning as he went. And I ask you, would we have it any other way? If we could succeed without struggle, would we appreciate the successes? If we did not need to cooperate with others to accomplish something worthwhile, would we value relationships and teamwork? I have a good friend who hates doing anything he's not good at. As you can imagine, this severely limits his options. He doesn't want to speak another language because he might sound like a child. He doesn't want to go to a contra dance because he does not know the steps. He doesn't want to try a new restaurant because he might not like the food. And he is paralyzed at the thought of hiking or camping or boating because he might get dirty or wet or look like a fool. My friend spends a lot of time at home. After a while, people just stop asking him if he'd like to go somewhere or do something. Then he complains that his friends don't invite him anywhere. Anyone who learns to do anything well has to look like a fool first. There are very few instant virtuosos among us. One of my favorite characters in the Hebrew scriptures is Moses. Moses is deeply flawed, and yet God insists on using him to lead the Israelites out of slavery. Remember the little argument that they had about whether Moses would work for God or not? It went something like this. Moses was shepherding the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, and he led the flock to the west end of the wilderness and came to the mountain Horeb. There God appeared to him in flames of fire blazing out of the middle of a bush. Moses looked. The bush was blazing away, but it didn't burn up. Moses said, "What the heck? I cannot believe my eyes." And God replied from the bush, "Moses, I have got a job for you. You are going to lead the Israelites out of Egypt." "You have got the wrong Moses," Moses replied. I'm a shepherd. I'm no leader. Now let me get back to work. Not so fast, buddy, God said. You are exactly the Moses that I'm looking for. But I stutter, said Moses, and I have real anger management issues. Go to my brother Aaron. He is a much better choice. No, replied God. I want you to do it, and I will help you. Remembering that this is just a story, look how it turned out. Moses argued with God at every step of the way. He had to get his brother Aaron to help him speak to Pharaoh. He had to get his sister Miriam to help him convince the Israelites to cross the Red Sea. Then, when they were in the wilderness, it took two trips up Mount Sinai for Moses to get the Ten Commandments because he smashed the first set in a fit of rage. The people quarreled with Moses and they grumbled about his leadership. They even built a golden calf to worship while Moses was away talking to God. The story tells us that they all wandered around together in the wilderness for 40 years. That is a long time. And then, when they finally did reach the promised land, Moses was too old and too frail to enter it with them. It's no wonder Moses didn't want anything to do with that burning bush. The beauty of the Moses story is that God does not want perfection. God wants faithfulness. It is clear in the story that Moses' doubts and fears are of little concern to anyone but himself. It is precisely because Moses is so human, so ordinary, so clumsy, that people trust him enough to follow him. Moses is one of the people. He is not a regal ruler like Pharaoh. He doesn't try to be a hero. Moses involves others in his leadership. He wades into the various tasks that are set before him, knowing full well that he has never done anything like this before, and that ultimately, that's okay. A person's desire for perfection comes from a place of insecurity. Good enough comes from a place of confidence. Moses can see the big picture. His job is to move the Israelites from bondage to freedom. How he does it matters very little. Have you ever seen your own burning bush? Have you ever had something stop you in your tracks and demand your attention? Have you ever felt like God or nature or the universe or the spirit of life was talking directly to you? Burning bushes are not rare. Chances are good that something like this has happened to you. A burning bush is that moment during a wedding when you realize that you want to work harder on your relationship with your spouse. It's realizing during a memorial service that you have not been living up to your own life's potential. It's that feeling during a child dedication calling you to do more to support the raising of all children. It's that urge of generosity when someone asks you to give money to something that you care about. It's deciding at age 42 that you always wanted to become a doctor and going to medical school. Burning bushes are not rare occasions. They are not something that happens to other people. Each burning bush, no matter how big or how small, is an invitation to us to take off our shoes because we are standing on holy ground. The fact that you are never quite ready for a burning bush does not stop it from happening. The misgivings you have about your readiness to answer the call do not make burning bushes appear less frequently. the fullness of your life and the precision of your days do not make you immune to a burning bush that appears telling you to do things differently. It is precisely at the most inopportune time that such signs come. For they come when you have gotten off track and need to find your way back. Luckily, however, you do not need to figure out how to get back on track on your own. One of the true gifts of religious community is simply this. You are part of a congregation that journeys from the burning bush to the wilderness to the promised land together. Vicky Wyda told me, if you want to change the world, serve a congregation. As a very involved Methodist laywoman, I knew that she did not mean to imply that ordained ministry was the only way or even the best way to serve. Rather, it is the service of each and every one of us that matters. We all minister to one another and to the world. Each of you has the great honor and responsibility of being part of a congregation that has boldly ministered to this community, the surrounding communities, and the wider world since 1636. I don't know if you know what high esteem this congregation is held in. I don't know if you fully grasp how your leadership ripples out into Unitarian Universalism. I don't know if you have heard the awe in people's voices when they say, "Oh, you're from First Parish in Concord." Yours is one of our denomination's flagship churches. People far and wide look to you for leadership, innovation, inspiration, and courage. My guess is that you take the same aw shucks attitude that Moses took, that you may doubt that your leadership is anything special. Humility is a wonderful thing until it keeps a person or an institution from leading. All the humility in the world could not get Moses out of the work that he had to do. And I hope the same is true for First Parish. We can go somewhere together, you and I. I count it as great good fortune to be standing here before you today. I can scarce believe that you might give me this pulpit this afternoon. And I know that it will take a bit of time to sink in, that I can walk the same streets and paths as Margaret Fuller and Henry David Thoreau, that I will lead the church of Louisa May Alcott and Barzilai Frost, and that the Hawthorns and the Emersons and the Peabodys accompany me. When Reverend Peter Bulkley and that band of hardy Puritans set out from Boston in 1635, they did not know if their wilderness adventure to live in concord with the native peoples would succeed or not. A mere stone's throw from here, they set up temporary shelters and then set to building this congregation's first meeting house. Surely there were some among that group who regretted leaving the comforts of Boston. Surely there were some in that group who greatly feared the Indians, not to mention the wild animals living around them. Surely there were some who longed for the security of a coastline or a bay on which boats to safety might be anchored. And yet they stayed. They stayed long enough to see a church built and a town founded. They stayed long enough to see children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren born and raised here. In fact, they are still here. And through the years, minister after minister has stood in this pulpit, leading the congregation as well as he or she could. Both the world and the church have changed a lot since Reverend Peter Bulkley's time. They have changed since Ralph Waldo Emerson's time. And of course, they have changed since Dana McLean Greeley's time and Gary Smith's time and Jenny Rankin's time. Ours is a faith that moves constantly forward, though not necessarily always in a straight line. My hope for First Parish is that you always do seemingly contradictory things simultaneously. I want First Parish to stay the same, and I want you to change. I want you to hold on to your history, and I want you to make new history. I want you to revere your past, and I want you to embrace your future. I want you to remember your elders. And I want you to celebrate your children and your youth. I want this church to be humble and exalted. I want your roots to hold you close. I want your wings to set you free. I want to walk with you into the unknown together, leading and following interchangeably as one does in a dance. I'm sure there are pitfalls that await me. I expect to learn as much in my second ministry as I learned in my first, though I don't have to be reminded to beware of open graves and dogs as ring bearers again. I promise you this morning that I will make mistakes and I will apologize for them. I will disappoint each and every one of you at some point. And I will also do the very best I know how to help lead this church. For it is not my church yet. It is your church. It always has been. You are the ones who ultimately get to decide where First Parish will go and what we will do together. I will walk with you, gently prodding where that is needed, standing and cheering in moments of triumph, and helping pick up the pieces when something falls apart. I will walk beside you in each moment of our shared living. I can promise you this because I know when a minister and a congregation love one another, they can accomplish amazing things together. When love comes first, there's no disagreement, large or small, that will knock us off course. If you want to change the world, serve a congregation. This is exactly what I expect to do. Come with me, will you? So be it. Amen.